delighted that you've been able to come to Sussex this afternoon to talk to us on the subject of criminal law and bureaucracy. Has it all gone too far?
Well, thank you very much indeed, Stephen. I'm tempted to say after that introduction that I probably should sit down straight away and not spoil the image that's been created. But I'm delighted and very privileged and proud to be invited here to give this lecture, particularly after such a distinguished speaker as Pat Scotland. I don't think I can match her either for eloquence or for the number of her criminal convictions. But nonetheless, with her coming before me and Michael Mansfield afterwards, I'm definitely the ham in some sort of sandwich. The talk I'm going to give you today is, in fact, part of an ongoing piece of research that I'm doing, but I'm not quite sure whether it's going to work or not. And so I've come here today really to try it out on you, or at least part of it on you, to see whether it does work, and if not, what it is that I need to do in order to improve it. And what I'm going to do is, I'm going to give you today what I could usefully call the case for the prosecution. That is the case that there is indeed too much criminal law and too much bureaucracy, which I'm sure all of you, before you've even heard a word, are already all too willing to agree with as a proposition. Because we hear that proposition being put about, don't we, by any number of politicians from all different divides, by newspaper commentators and the like. It's almost as if you've said it often enough, it becomes true. So what I'm going to do is conduct today the case for the prosecution, although from time to time I will hint at what might eventually become the case for the defence. But the case for the defence is quite complex, it's historical, it's elusive, it's more difficult to put together, so I won't bother with it today. I will merely hint at what might be contained in the case for the defence. I want to start, though, with just saying a few words, for those of you who don't know much about it, about the Law Commission. And that is, in an indirect way, relevant to what I'm going to say more generally. So I do want to start a little bit with that, whilst at the same time that gives me an opportunity to grapple with the technical aspects of the show here. Now, what happens if I do that? Nothing. Hang on, let me see. I'm sorry? Aha. Hang on. Ah, right. Sorry. Oh, yes, that does work. Right. Sorry about that. The Law Commission was founded in 1965, and as you can see here, it has 60 or 70 staff, making it the biggest law commission in the world. And there are very many such law commissions. Almost all Commonwealth or former Commonwealth countries have them. There are well over 100, something like 140, I think it is. And the one in England and Wales is the biggest, and there are separate commissions in Scotland and in Northern Ireland. And as you can see there are five legal teams operating in different areas. I head the one on criminal law, criminal procedure and criminal evidence, but there are also teams dealing with property and family, on the one hand, commercial and common law, and also public law. So very, very different, disparate areas of the law of England and Wales. We also, as of about 2005, we've had an economics team to help us to evaluate the impact of our work, which is something the government requires all its departments to do now. In other words, to count the cost of introducing legal reform, not just in pounds, shillings and pence, or euros, but in fact also in terms of its impact on other areas of the criminal justice system. For example, if we introduce this reform, will there be a need for more judges? Will there be a need for more courts? And so on and so forth. Those kinds of impacts are now meant to be integral to all law reform projects across government. And Law Commission is no exception to that. We do impact assessments, and the economics team helps us to do that. And there's a corporate services team, of course, helping us with things like IT and publicity and so on. But we also, uniquely, we have parliamentary counsel attached to the Law Commission, as some of you may know. And that makes us different to any other independent quango or pressure group or whatever you might like to call such groups, in that we have professional draftspeople who in fact turn our reports into legislation that, if need be, could be taken straight to the floor of the House and implemented there and then. I mean, that very rarely, if ever, happens. But nonetheless, we start with a properly drafted bill with almost all our reports. And that puts us in a unique and unusual position. That's not the case in any other law commission, so far as I know, in other jurisdictions. What is our remit? Well, our remit, and this brings me more to the focus of my talk today, our remit under the Law Commissions Act of 1965 is to take and keep under review all the law with which they, that is the commissions, are concerned, with a view to its systematic development and reform, including in particular the codification of such law, the reduction of the number of separate enactments, and generally the simplification and modernisation of the law. Now, in 1965, that might not have looked like much of a task, but now even the quite considerable resources of the English Law Commission are woefully short of being able to give that ideal across the whole of the law to turn that into any kind of reality. Nonetheless, let me just look at our record to date to show that it's not too shabby. Since 1965, 176 final reports on law reform, 43 reports on consolidation of the law, that is the gathering together of statutes in the same area in one piece of legislation, and 17 reports on the repeal of obsolete statutes, so turnpike legislation, and an awful lot of rather interesting legislation on the administration of empire, which is now redundant. Don't let me go off down on that track. And two-thirds of those reports have been implemented in whole or in part. And 90 Acts of Parliament since 65 have had some Law Commission recommendations in them. So that's not a bad record, really. But of course, that's in the abstract. That doesn't tell you how much law has been created and reformed during the course of that time. So it doesn't give you a picture of how significant a player we are, albeit quite successful in our own terms. How successfully are we in the big picture? Well, let me turn then to the amount of law that we've got. But just before I get to that, now here is a picture of Solon the legislator, the 9th century Greek legislator, and who not only devised a code of law for his own country, but being a poet, he set it to verse so that the ordinary people will be able to understand it all the better. Although at the Law Commission, we haven't yet thought of getting the Poet Laureate on board to try and turn our reform proposals into poetry as a means of communicating them to the average citizen. We haven't thought about that. But in a way, I've given that example because here, I think, is a point at which we can cite Aristotle on the great souled man, the megaloptsuchia. Because in a way, that summarises the approach of the Law Commission, albeit in a rather cheeky way, to law reform. Aristotle says of the great souled man, he is slow to act except where there is great honour at stake, and he is inclined to perform only a few actions, though great and renowned ones. Because nothing matters to him, he will not be rushed. His movements are slow, his voice is deep, his speech measured. Now here we have conjured up, it seems to me, the picture of the law commissioner or parliamentary counsel, working in this measured, steady, rational way towards law reform. Now, keep that image in your head as the image of the way the law commissioner does law reform. And just to remind you, our obligation is to take and keep under review all the law in England and Wales with which we are concerned. How easy is it to fulfil that obligation? Well, in 1965, there were a staggering 7,567 pages of legislation, just in one year. But, in 2005, there were 20,800 pages, and the pages are 11% bigger than they were in 1965. That is the amount of legislation in one single year entering upon the statute book. Now, how is this possible? Well, of course, some of you, perhaps the older people in the audience, will recall that in the period between 1965 and 2005, we joined a certain organisation called the European Union. And a certain amount of legislation is alleged to stem from that body. And indeed, most of these new pages in modern legislation are statutory instruments, SIs, I've called them there for short. They are delegated legislation made under already existing statutes. But only a minority of these, in all fairness, are what you might broadly call Euro law. Only a minority. Most of the law that we now create is our own fault, if I could put it in that way, and is not there because we're being obliged to put it there by some external or indeed integrally internal body like the EU. Now, since 1997, 477 public general acts, that is ordinary acts of Parliament, and statutory instruments passed, an enormous number in just that short period since the Labour government came to power. Just to give you a comparison, in 1837 there were seven public general acts in that year. Although this has fluctuated over time. If you pick out the year of the Law Commission's foundation, it's 1965, 83 public general acts. And even as late as 2005, there are only 24. But the numbers of pages is increasing, so we're taking a lot longer to say whatever it is that we intend to say in legislation. And that's clear from the amount of pages involved in far fewer public general acts in 2005 than there were in 1965. Acts are getting longer, basically, is the short answer to that. But how about criminal legislation in particular? How much of that is there? Well, let's take Halsbury's Laws. Now, Halsbury's Laws are not much consulted by students, and understandably so. But they are an encyclopedic reference set of volumes, like the Encyclopaedia Britannica or something. They're the Encyclopaedia Britannica of law, if you like. And volume one of criminal legislation covers a period no less than 637 years, from 1351, when we passed the Treason Act, still in force, which is why it's there, up to 1988. And these amounted to 1,382 pages. Volumes 2 to 4 cover 1989 to 2008, a period of a mere 19 years, in which we've managed to generate 3,746 pages of legislation. So a quite staggering increase in the number of, in the sheer volume of criminal law created since 1989, when the period where Halsbury divides volumes 2 to 4. You might wonder how on earth they managed to keep hold of any kind of control of society at all between 1351 and 1988 with such little by way of criminal legislation on the statute book. How on earth did they manage? Well, an interesting question. Now, let us contrast the great souled man of Aristotelian fame, slowly and making in his measured way law reform, with the modern lawmaker, much parodied in the newspapers. Now, here's a quote from Private Eye, dating back to about 2005, I think it was. "What the eye says Private Eye, the shame of Britain's binge lawmaking, they say. Groups of middle-aged men and women could be seen sprawling about on green leather benches in an all-night session of reckless lawmaking. These people were just spewing out law after law. It was sickening," says the Eye, and concludes with the quote, "There should be a law against it." But here we have here, of course, we have the picture of John Bull consuming the French fleet, actually, as it happens. But nonetheless, I thought that totally gratuitously a convenient image to put up next to such a quote as an image of the legislator. But so, first of all, we have the image of sort of binge drinking and vomiting out masses of law. But a different bodily metaphor we find in this more recent attack by Chris Huhne, the Liberal Democrat MP, on the 22nd of January, when he says, "Over the last 12 years, this government has been suffering from the most acute and prolonged bout of legislative diarrhea." So we've got a rather different kind of metaphor being used. In more measured tones, the Lord Chief Justice, or the then Lord Chief Justice, Igor Judge, said, "The tidal wave of criminal justice legislation is relentless," he says, "and although it constantly seems to come in, unlike the tide, it never seems to ebb," he said in 2007. So a little less graphic in his use of metaphor, nonetheless. And this has been picked up in the popular press. I mentioned that at the start. So here we have the Daily Mirror, or Daily Mail, I'm so sorry, on that same day, 22nd of January. "Labour's dreaming up 33 new crimes a month," they say, "including barring you from swimming into the Titanic." Although, of course, they failed to point out that the Titanic is a war grave, is an official grave, I'm sorry, so maybe one shouldn't actually be swimming around in it. But let me not pick issues up in relation to individual laws. And they go on to say, between 1997 and 2000, 4,289 new criminal offences were created, approximately one for every day ministers have been in office. Twice the rate at which the new crimes were created under the Tories, they add right at the end. Although one might still wonder how so much legislation was even being passed by the Conservatives. But nonetheless, point taken. we have had a dramatic increase in the amount of criminal legislation under Labour. Not much doubting that. Okay. Well, we've seen the Punch and Judy stuff, the MPs accusing one another, newspapers producing dramatic headlines. Now we need to do some number crunching, I think, to try to get some perspective on this. How much truth is there in all these claims? And if there is truth in them, well, who's to blame? Who is the person, the people, the body introducing all this stuff, to give it its technical, legalistic name? Since 1997, about 3,000 new offences were created by 2002. You can't always exactly specify, because offences are sometimes... Two offences will be aggregated into one, but under separate clauses. It's not possible to give an exact figure. But something like 3,000 new offences, scattered across all departments. But some of the big players were, Home Office, Ministry of Justice, you'd expect that, 404. But incredibly, the Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, 640 offences they managed to produce during this period. More even than the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice, way more. And even the Foreign Office managed to create 227, largely in relation to offences committed by peacekeepers and so on in their operations in Bosnia and various other places. But nonetheless, a pretty impressive catalogue of offence creation. You have to go back to a broader picture here, because a lot of new offences are created by statutory instrument. And I talked about the 37,000 statutory instruments created since 1997, I think it was. And remember that statutory instruments are drafted and put on the statute book by civil servants. They're put under the nose of the minister, who probably knows absolutely nothing about what the regulation involves. And I'll explain why very shortly. No minister on this earth could understand some of the stuff that goes through. And we'll see some interesting examples. But statutory instruments are what I'm calling here civil servant-led criminal law. In other words, not the criminal law that's debated in theatrical terms through Parliament, which we're all more familiar with. And here we have a picture of a civil servant looking up at the sign that says, "All government employees must wash their hands of all responsibility before returning to work." Perhaps quite apposite in this context. John Spencer, for example, saying, "Those who prepare legislation lack a basic knowledge of the underlying law," he complains, "and don't trouble to consult those who have it." In other words, me, says Professor Spencer. In relation to civil servants in particular areas, I would beg to differ, actually. There is a lot of expertise in, for example, the Department of Environment on what they are meant to be doing. The question is whether they should be trying to do it through the criminal law, really. But anyway, let me give you some examples. Here's some regulations I picked up just for your amusement and entertainment. There's no scholarly value in this whatsoever, so you can just enjoy yourself. The Apple and Pear Orchard Grubbing Up Regulations, 1998. When I mentioned that in a humorous spirit to an agricultural lawyer, they looked at me with a blank face and said, "Well, actually, that's an extremely important regulation." The Mink Keeping Order, 1987. The Imitation Dummies Safety Regulations, 1993. The Heads of Sheep and Goats Order, 1996, and the Baking and Sausage Making Christmas and New Year Regulations, 1985. No idea what they were about. But it gets worse. Here's two real classics. The Excise Duties Hydrocarbon Oil Travelling Showman Relief Regulations of 1989. And I think this is my absolute best hit for one of the best laws this century. The N-nitrosamines and N-nitrosatable substances in elastoma or rubber teats and dummies safety regulations, 1995. Wow, I managed to get through that without a slip. Not too bad. But of course, actually very important. It's about chemicals that might be transmissible to a baby through the use of rubber teats. So I'm not criticising the passing of the regulation. In fact, and here we can see a bit of the case for the defence creeping through the undergrowth, that actually a lot of these laws are cited by politicians because they sound funny and amusing and pointless. But actually, when you get down and into the context, you find that there's a perfectly good reason for having them. Not in all instances. I'm of course not saying that. But one has to be a bit careful. But nonetheless, there we are. So back to the question of who's creating all this stuff. The figures I gave you a little while ago were actually produced by... Nick Clegg, in fact, in a speech in the House of Commons. And I'm going to criticise something that he said there in relation to those in a moment. But now, here, typically, perhaps I should say, I've got some stuff wrong here. So please ignore the 2009 figures, because it's very, very difficult to tell what you're looking at. And I only picked half-yearly figures. So with the figure next to 2009 is only a half-year figure, so you can probably about double it in each case. So there hasn't been a drop in 2009 at all. If anything, I think it's 3,800, but nonetheless. But we can see from this, if we concentrate on the 2008 figures, and 2007, 2008 figures, then we can see that actually the big legislating departments, criminal law creating departments, or statutory instrument creating departments, are DEFRA, Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, Treasury, Transport, another big creator of statutory instruments, and quite well down, actually, is the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice. Although, of course, if you put them together, 113 and 181, of course, they'd rise to the top. And that's an important point I'm going to allude to later, that sometimes politicians are misled about about the amount of law that's being passed by departments, because they forget that departments get amalgamated. And so the end-of-year figures reflect the two departments being put together. And that's the mistake, or the trap Nick Clegg fell into. But anyway, let me come back to that. But we can see here that actually there are plenty of big players in terms of law creation other than the Home Office Ministry of Justice. And here I put up what I call a league table of shame, and that is taking the longitudinal look from 1987 to 1997. So over a 10-year period, who are the worst offenders? And actually, bizarrely, it's education. Or maybe not that bizarrely, because of course we're all used to ministers interfering with what goes on in schools. Or maybe interfere is a loaded term, I shouldn't say that. Helping out to improve what goes on in schools. That's better. And they are right at the top of the league table of shame, as producing 743 SIs over that period, some 5% of the total. Social Security, as they were back in 1987, right up there too. Agriculture. But notice here that in 1987, what is now DEFRA was disaggregated. We had a Department of Agriculture, we had food, we had sea fisheries, a separate division. These were disaggregated at that time in the way they're not now. But it's interesting, I think, to see who tops the league. And it's not necessarily who you would think, is it? Now, what I've done is amalgamate some of the departments to see who a modernised league table of shame would look like in those terms. So what I've done is add up these figures in relation to a modern department. And DCLOG, as they're called, Local Government Housing Rating Evaluation Planning and Council Tax, gobble up 10% of statutory instruments that we're creating. And the Department for the Environment, Food, Rural Affairs are another 10%, basically. Whereas, interesting, the Ministry of Justice in their portfolio are only 6.15%, so well behind those other departments. And you'll remember that when I gave that figure, if I go back to it somewhere here, that figure for DEFRA, you see, when it was given by Nick Clegg in the House of Commons, he gave the figure for 2002, I'm sorry, or 2000, I think it was when he gave the statement. But that was the very year in which DEFRA was amalgamated. The Department of Environment was amalgamated with all these other ones. And so actually the figure that he gave is misleading, because that 640 figure is actually an amalgamation of several different departments. So it's not really fair to say, actually, that one department is creating all this mass of legislation. That's just an arbitrary reflection of what departments, of the way that of departments are put together. Okay. Well, here are some civil servant-created crimes. Disturbing a pack of eggs when directed not to do so by an authorised officer. Jack Straw himself had to defend the creation of that particular crime. I can't remember what the justification was, but he seemed to think it was a very serious matter. I've already mentioned entering the hull of the Titanic without permission from the Secretary of State. An older one, possessing a dead badger, is an offence. Actually, that was an offence under the Conservatives brought that in, so I'm being totally fair. That was that came in 1992, I think it was. Ship's captain, sorry, the grammar's gone a bit awry here, in order that I can fit it onto two lines. So when carrying grain, failing to ensure there's an international grain code aboard. And here's one of my favourites from the Bees Act 1980. Failing to give notice to the Secretary of State that one thinks one's beehive is infected with American fowl brood, which no doubt beekeepers here will be very familiar with and will say, ooh, terribly serious matter. But to be fair, the legislation prohibits equally or requires you to report equally on an infestation of European fowl brood, which apparently is quite separate, obviously, from American fowl brood, a very different animal indeed. And here's a recent one, a rather curious one I found, from the 2008 regulations, the Transmissible Spongiform Encephalopathy Regulations 2008, removing a bovine animal from a semen collection centre except to kill it, which is a curious one. But again, here is an offence aimed clearly at reducing the possibility that you might get one of these appalling diseases from bovine animals, and so in itself no doubt fully defensible. But it's just the kind of thing that politicians like to bandy about as showing how trivialised the criminal law has become. Just for a comparison here, I've done something on America, and a little bit random, but the rate of imprisonment in America, if you take that as the measure of whether there's too much criminal law, rather than the mere passing of criminal legislation, supposing you take the rate of imprisonment as being a more significant indicator of government intervention in criminal law terms, the rate of imprisonment in 1970 was 144 inmates to 100,000 residents, whereas in 2005 it was 737 inmates per 100,000 residents at a cost of a cool £185 billion. And we can come and compare those figures with those that obtain here later on, and you'll see in European countries it's very, very significantly lower than that. So how you measure, I think, the interventionist nature of the state, I think, is a value judgment, and some might prefer to look at it in those terms rather than in the terms in which I'm looking at it. But still. And a little look at President Obama's home state, Illinois. Similar problems, really. 1961, there or thereabouts the time when the Law Commission here was founded, 24,000 words, the criminal code. 2003, 136,000 words. So again, they're experiencing the same kinds of increase, really. And there's a little bit down there about federal statute law, too, being pretty expansive. One civil servant saying to another, it's a 300-page government questionnaire about cutting back on bureaucracy. Yes, well, quite. Now, if I turn my mind specifically from the criminal law to bureaucrats, well, what have we got? Well, one indicator about increasing amounts of legislation is the number of parliamentary counsel that you require to draft legislation. In 1901, there were a mere two parliamentary draftsmen. That's it. In 1961, there were only 16. In 1983, 24. But now there are 59 people engaged busily in drafting legislation. Quite an amazing increase over that period. Now, one of the reasons for that is that in the olden days, if you wanted a piece of legislation on the statute book, you could go away and get it privately drafted. Well, you still can, actually. And privately drafted acts of parliament were a not uncommon feature of legislation in a bygone era. But in the 70s and 80s, it became considered that that was not a good way of introducing legislation into parliament, because it meant that you had inconsistencies in the usage of statutory language across the statute book as a whole. And wouldn't it be better, bureaucratically, in terms of clarity and all these other considerations, to have all drafting of legislation undertaken in-house, hence the growth of parliamentary counsel. Just by way of comparison, Treasury economists I've got in there, people analysing why what they said yesterday was going to happen today turned out not to be true. How many of those are there? Well, in 1963, there were 19 economists working in the Treasury. Now they recruit 136, something like that. A massive increase in the number of people analysing our behaviour and patterns and so on. And in the Ministry of Justice, the Home Office, I haven't managed to find any historic figures for the numbers that they employed. But there are 115,000 people working in those departments, spending $10.5 billion. If you see a group of five civil servants talking together, one of them at least will be working for the Ministry of Justice. So a very, very important player in terms of law creation. But now here's something interesting, bearing on what I was saying earlier on. You remember earlier on I said that the Ministry of Justice and Home Office was not actually the most culpable offender in terms of creating criminal law. Well, here's some backup to that, actually, because prior to 1997, the creation of criminal law was the job of a group called C4. It sounds like some sort of private security firm, but in fact, it was a group or division within the Ministry of Justice. And they were responsible for criminal law evidence, procedure, victims' injury compensation. And there are about 15 of them working there. Now there are about 20. It went up to 25 at one point. There are about 20 now working on crime creation, I'm calling it. Although actually it includes, of course, abolishing old-fashioned crimes. But mostly it's on crime creation. So in fact, the growth has been pretty modest over the period that I'm mainly discussing. Pretty modest. The people working on reform of the criminal law. Well, let's turn to the legal service as a whole, a common target for government cutbacks. I'm sure they're quaking in their fancy leather shoes right now about what the government might be intending to do by way of cutbacks. Well, the Ministry of Justice has 115 lawyers and the Home Office 55. And that includes the Lord Chancellor's department, the old Lord Chancellor's department. Department for the Environment, etc., has 100. Revenue and Customs Prosecution, 95. Department for Business, 93. Department for Transport, 91. So again, we've got these same usual suspects coming back. There seems to be a correlation, I wonder why it is, between the number of lawyers in a department and the amount of law, statutory instruments and crimes they create. Must be an explanation somewhere, I would have thought. Now, here's a contrast for you. The Attorney General's department, you heard from her last time. The Attorney General, of course, now with the downgrading of the Lord Chancellor, the Attorney General is now primarily responsible for the rule of law in this country. Well, she has 16 lawyers working to make sure that we observe standards relating to the rule of law. Health and Safety Executive has 9 lawyers helping them to prevent what is, after all, the most common source of accidents other than in the home. Food Standards, 7. Criminal Injuries Compensation, 4. And Department for Vehicle Licensing, poor person, whoever it might be, just the one lawyer there. And changes over a decade, well, Department for Constitutional Affairs or Ministry of Justice Home Office has gone up from 141 to 221 in that 10-year period. And likewise, Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food, as was, gone up from 44 to 112. Contrast then the ones I've just referred to. Their increases have been pretty minimal over that period. 11 to 17, food standards the same. Criminal injuries compensation has gone down. DVLC, well, it's the same person, presumably, I suppose, or perhaps probably. And the Department for Business, actually, about the same. So there have been some significant shifts in numbers of lawyers in at least some of these departments. Who, more broadly, are authorities capable of creating criminal and regulatory? Well, actually, there's an extraordinary number, far more than you'd think. 63 national regulators are capable of creating regulations and laws. 203 training standards offices, 408 environmental health offices, 486 local authorities, and, of course, the small matter of the EU and the World Trade Organization, all capable of producing plenty of legislation by way of regulation. Now, here we have the bogey of the right and the far left, for that matter, the EU. Of the 20,000 pages I mentioned in 2005, 13,000 were statutory instruments, but, actually, not so vast was, in fact, the impact of European Union legislation. 88 European directives, 461 regulations, amounting to a substantial, but by comparison not terribly weighty, 5,500 odd pages. EU law is about 15% of delegated legislation. UKIP put the figure at 93%, but that's actually focusing on a very narrow area where you can only legislate through EU law. They're being a little bit naughty, actually, with the statistics, I believe. Most commentators agree that the amount of EU law that has to be translated into delegated legislation is between 10 and 20%, something like that. So they're not the serial offender that some people would take them to be. Now, let me move on to some explanations of this phenomenon. Now, one of the explanations is the creation that has really gathered force since 1997 of bodies with a vested interest in creating regulations within their own field of competence. Financial Services Authority, we've heard a fair bit about them in recent times. And why we all have to make cutbacks because they weren't doing their job properly or something like that. They have a general rulemaking power. They may create such rules as appear to be necessary or expedient for the purpose of protecting the interests of consumers. And in that regard, they can impose fines. And one was imposed relatively recently on Aon, the insurer. £5.25 million for failing to take reasonable care to organise and manage their affairs effectively with adequate risk management, which is bureaucratic speak for letting a few things drop out of the accounts that should have been in there. That is a not untypical picture. Here we have another body relatively recently created, the Independent Safeguarding Authority, which is designed to make sure that people like Ian Huntley don't get employed by schools. Now, he's got a lot to answer for, actually, in terms of the way that there's been an increase in bureaucracy and intervention and general checking and so forth, so on and so forth. Often happens that way. Hard cases making bad law. And under the Safeguarding Vulnerable Groups Act, the Secretary of State, although not him or her, of course, it'll inevitably be someone further down the line, the head of the Independent Safeguarding Authority, probably, may make regulations as to persons permitted to engage in controlled activity, like working in schools or as a babysitter and so on, and the circumstances in which a responsible person must not permit another to engage in controlled activity. So at one further remove, and that is aimed at the agencies who hire out staff to schools, to parents and to others. So a very broad remit to make regulations covered by fines. Another example, the Animal Welfare Act 2006, the appropriate national authority made by regulations makes such provision as the authority thinks fit, so no test of necessity or anything, for promoting the welfare of animals. And if they create an offence under that provision, Section 12, by Section 32, the person is liable to imprisonment or a fine as may be provided by those regulations. So the national authority responsible for animal welfare can decide, for example, that no one should be allowed to leave their dog on a lead in the rain when they're doing their shopping in the supermarket, and they can create that as an offence and say that you can be imprisoned up to 6 months, although if the Conservatives get it'll be up to a year, for that offence. They have power to do that. And here is another example, then, of a quango being given power to create criminal offences, including imprisonable criminal offences, something I personally don't think is right, but you may disagree. And some curious offences in the Act itself. Transfer of animals by way of a sale or prize. This was much discussed at the time, but has rather gone out of the public domain in terms of discussion. A person commits an offence, an imprisonable one actually, if he enters into an arrangement with a person whom he has reasonable cause to believe to be under the age of 16, and the arrangement is one under which that person has the chance to win an animal as a prize. So this is the goldfish in the bowl at the fair syndrome, or in the plastic bag. If you enter into an arrangement, etc., with some youth who says, please, sir, can I have a goldfish? Then by entering into that arrangement, you commit an offence. Well, that's all right, some of you may say. But of course, the legislation forgot to say, which it should have said, that the child who says, please, mister, can I have a goldfish, please, should not be guilty of inciting that offence to be committed, because at the moment they are. So the legislation is demonstrably over-inclusive, I would say, but there it is. That's typical of many pieces of legislation, not properly thought through. Now, here are some examples of the Safeguarding Vulnerable Groups Act, some pretty swinging penalties, actually, a person commits an offence if he permits an individual to engage in regulated activity from which that individual is barred, and a 5-year maximum penalty for that. Pretty swinging, actually. You might permit the individual to engage in the regular activity even though they're barred because you think they shouldn't have been barred, that it was wrong. You stand to spend 5 years inside for that. So a pretty swinging penalty when you consider that no actual harm is necessarily done when you commit this offence. It's merely a sort of gateway offence or something that may lead to harm in the future. So one feature of the current law then has been the growth of quangos or bureaucracies who are themselves entitled to create criminal law. In other words, the government has allowed, if you like, has a sort of free market to develop amongst quangos in law creation, rather than keeping it all within the Ministry of Justice or within departments. And that I regard as a dangerous development myself. We can blame departments for creating too much law. Departments are accountable directly to ministers. Much harder to get at quangos, who are quasi-autonomous when they do these things. Another feature of modern law, particularly since Labour have come in, but not solely then, is the number of supposedly civil law measures, and if you breach them, you then commit a criminal offence. Football Spectators Act, banning orders, stopping hooligans from going abroad, that sort of thing. ASBOs, well, we know all about those. They are civil orders, at least in theory, but if you breach one, you then commit a criminal offence. Sex offence prevention orders, similarly. Non-molestation orders. Serious offence prevention orders. Violent offender orders. Anti-gang violence orders. The list goes on. All of these are preventative civil measures imposed on people, restricting their movements or preventing them from doing things or going to places. And if in itself that's not an offence, but if they breach the conditions that are set down, then they commit an offence. And that's a modern development, or a relatively modern development, and it's one that's led to a lot more use of the criminal law when people do breach the conditions. Now, here's another interesting example, actually, of, and I'm sure some of you will be very familiar with this debate, about how here the investigative state has been allowed to develop in a relatively unregulated kind of way. Regulator Investigatory Powers Act 2000, not a lot of people know about this act. What it does is entitles bodies, it authorises bodies to use surveillance and covert human intelligence. In other words, spying, but we don't use that term. Covert human intelligence. Who can use covert human intelligence, spies, plainclothes police officers, etc., or authorised surveillance? Who can do that? Well, police force, fine. National Criminal Intelligence Service doesn't exist anymore, but they have the power. National Crime Squad, Serious Fraud Office, Armed Forces, Intelligence Services, Home Office, that seems fine, no problem there. Customs and Excise, Inland Revenue, Department of Health, strange. Department of Transport, well, what would they want it for, I wonder? Department of Social Security, as was, maybe. Department of Business, what are they doing in there? And, of course, the DEFRA, couldn't leave them out, they're involved in everything, aren't they? And the National Assembly for Wales and any local authority. Well, we know about them because they're allegedly going to attach surveillance devices to our bins to spy on us, aren't they? So the list is beginning to get rather more controversial, isn't it? And rather longer, and one's not sure really what it's doing. But it doesn't stop there, ladies and gentlemen. The Environment Agency, the Financial Services Authority, well, we know about them, the Food Standards Agency, the Personal Investment Authority, the Post Office, and finally the Charity Commission, all entitled to conduct surveillance and gather information by means of covert human intelligence. The very thing, in fact, which delayed the introduction of the police force in this country back in the early 19th century, because people were worried about plainclothes operations, where you wouldn't know whether the person you were talking to was a government spy or not. And that's why there was such an insistence on police uniforms. That's why if someone wants to enter your home on police business, one of the police officers must be in uniform. And that requirement has been retained. But here we are undermining, it seems to be, those safeguards. If you still think they're important, maybe you don't. I'll skip over that. A last point really is the growth generally of criminal bureaucracy. In my period of office, I have come across I don't know how many bodies looking from one perspective or another at the criminal law, those who break it, and those who are then designed to or meant to administer the follow-up action. Here we have a sequential list of things that have come in. Youth offending teams, multi-agency protection arrangements to make sure that offenders don't slip from one bureaucratic body to another without their criminal record going with them. Local strategic partnerships, local criminal justice boards, drug action teams, the National Offender Management Service, NOMS, or Nightmare on Marsham Street, as it's sometimes known. Prolific priority offender programs, local immigration teams. Then we have split-level government. We've got bodies at national level, like the Ministry of Justice, NOMS, the Youth Justice Board, UK Border Agency, and so on. We've got super-regional bodies. Then there are regional bodies, sub-regional bodies, and finally unitary council or district bodies, all trying to coordinate, no doubt, their action with one another somehow in the great bureaucratic sort of cloud of all unknowing in the sky. So rising managerialism is, I think, an issue here. And if we go back to the Audit Commission, 1996, its report, Misspent Youth, it commended what it called interagency cooperation, the necessity of an overall strategic plan, the creation of key performance indicators, and active monitoring of aggregate information about the system and its functioning. Well, that's bureaucrat speak, I think, for super management systems in which someone at the top, and increasingly you have to put someone over the person at the top so as to make sure the person at the top, or who was at the top, knows what they're doing and is doing it properly, you have all this, all these lines of accountability going up and down and responsibilities, which leads to the growth of the bureaucracy. And I got there at the body of the story of the inspector's inspector. There are a number of Her Majesty's inspectors of various criminal justice bodies. You've heard of Her Majesty's Inspector of Prisons, no doubt. But there's Her Majesty's Inspectors of the Crown Prosecution Service, Her Majesty's Inspectors of the Constabulary, Her Majesty's Inspectors of the Probation Service, and there used to be Her Majesty's Inspector of HM Court Service, but I hear that's gone. Well, somebody in 2004 said, well, we've got all Her Majesty's inspectors inspecting things, but who's inspecting the inspectors? How do we know they're all doing their jobs properly? So the proposal was, I kid you not, to introduce a super inspector of inspectors who would check that all Her Majesty's inspectors are doing their jobs properly. That was squashed at some point down the line. But that is symbolic, really, I think, of the kind of developments to which we've been subjected. And here we see some figures. £37 billion spent in 2007 on 827 bodies. There was a commitment by government to reduce the bodies. Fantastic. It's gone down from 827 to 766. Well done, government. Unfortunately, the cost has gone up from £37 billion to £46.5 billion to administer those remaining 766 bodies. If you look at the bottom, in the Republic of Ireland, all right, smaller population, I know, but they have over 800 quangos, but those cost only 13 billion euros. So they managed to do it at a much cheaper price, somehow or another. Just to let me conclude with a little bit of the case for defence. One of the problems here is that actually government has a lot more responsibilities than it used to have in, say, 1900. We're now much more concerned about things like animal welfare, about the environment, noise, waste, antisocial behaviour, border security, illegal employment of migrant workers, all of these issues. I don't say they're brand new, but they've come to prominence in a way that that government is now regarded as responsible for dealing with them, in a way that was not true 100 years ago. There's also issues about one rule for all. We have to pass European legislation, at least to some extent, to make sure that we are participating in common markets and so on an equal footing with other member states. It's not really fair to say, well, you, the other member states, can pass laws, if you like, to make these things compulsory. We're going to rely on trusting the honest British business person to do the right thing by European standards. Because that will not be acceptable, and understandably so, I think, to the European Commission, who will want to see some tangible evidence of commitment. And that will be true for matters of human rights and more generally in relation to international agreements. So although it's only a minority, I think our willingness to play by the rules on an equal footing will to some extent justifiably contribute to an increase in the statute book. So a little bit there by way of the case for the defence just to end. Well, I'll finish with a quote if I may. I've gone on too long, I know already. But And this is a quote from a colleague in a journal where he's talking about the complexity of public opinion. And he says, when confronted with particular policy challenges, removing sewage from drinking water, protecting consumers from dangerous foodstuffs, combating corporate crime, voters, politicians, interest groups often fight for strict regulations. However, when confronted with the entire body of regulation and regulatory procedures that result from such worthy initiatives, many of the same voters and politicians decry the excessive regulation and red tape. EC red tape is a tempting target for EC and particularly national politicians anxious to find a scapegoat for economic underperformance. And I think there's an element in all of us that would respond in a similar way. We're all tempted to say about specific instances, well, that's terrible, there should be a law preventing it, or some government body should do something to prevent it. But then when we look at the totality of what that produces, we're horrified by the sum total of what's been created. That's a very understandable human reaction, and I think that may explain quite a bit of where we are now. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy, for taking us through.